The Oldie Lunch Recordings presents The Somme, A New History by Professor Gary Sheffield. Brought to you by Doro, number one mobiles in the senior mobile market.
Our first speaker writes of war, and one who symbolised what we were fighting for, or did he? The story of Haig is a tangled web of controversy, but as I maddeningly hover, see, you are impatient. So no longer will I tarry. You try rhyming with Sheffield. Will you welcome Gary? Gary Sheffield!
Well, thank you very much indeed. And I'm truly privileged to have such a magnificent poem dedicated to me. Well, I'm probably just as well you've got me on first, because you get the grim bit out of the way. I'm going to attempt to defend the indefensible, or some people will think, by saying something about Douglas Haig and the Battle of the Somme and trying to be vaguely positive about it. So please bear with me. It's been an interesting few days. I'm a Somme historian. I mean, I'd like to think when I started off on my career path 30 years ago, I thought, gosh, in 2016, I'll be a senior professional. I'll be just ready to go and do all these literary festivals and literary lunches. Sadly, I wasn't quite as forward-thinking as that. But I have pretty well Sommed out over the last few days. I've given about 9 talks in the last 2 weeks. I was at the Westminster Abbey commemoration of the Somme Thursday evening. I think the Queen was there. I think I saw the brim of her hat anyway, but lots of people were there. And I was then up in Manchester the following 2 days as part of the Somme commemoration. And it's fairly obvious where most people's minds were resting on the Somme, with the men who fought and died. And of course, that is absolutely right. That should be the case, because the Somme was not actually the bloodiest battle in history, or the bloodiest battle of the First World War, though some people seem to think it was. But it was an absolutely appalling experience. And please don't think that anything I'm going to be saying over the next few minutes is trying to downplay that in any way. But there is a big but. Like any event in history, the Battle of the Somme and Douglas Haig's role in it must be placed in context. So, for example, the Battle of the Somme did not last one day. It lasted 141 days. And it was 141 days out of a war which lasted for 4 and a bit years. And to try and understand what happened on the Somme, I think we need to go back with some really basic stuff about the First World War. The first point to make is that although today we have a particular view of the First World War, I mean, many people would regard it as being futile, that is not how it was regarded at the time. And in fact, one of the most amazing things which came out of the Battle of the Somme was, amazing from our perspective anyway, was that the majority of the British population, in spite of everything, remained committed to the war. As bad as the war was, they thought there was something that was even worse, and that was defeat at the hands of Germany. Now, Germany actually has had, you know, the Germany of the First World War has actually had quite a good press, largely because what came later. Because compared to what happened in the Second World War, the Germany of the Kaiser seems quite benign by comparison. Actually, it wasn't. It was a very, very brutal and unpleasant regime. And more to the point, from our point of view, our parochial British point of view, it went round invading its neighbours. Now, when one of those neighbours happened to be Belgium, which is slap bang across the English Channel from us, and actually really posed a really significant threat to British security, that is the moment when Britain went to war. And throughout the First World War, people never lost sight of the reason why Britain was fighting. Basically, stop them in France and Germany, France and Belgium, or have them doing it at home. Which helps to explain why people from backgrounds, from working class backgrounds, which were seen unbelievably poor by our standards, actually supported the war. Because poor as they were, they had a better standard of living than they had had in their father's time, their grandfather's time, and they feared a German victory would snatch it all away. And people retained that perspective to the very end of the war, and many historians like myself would say they were not misguided to do so. The second point I want to make is, why was it that you had trench deadlock in the First World War? Well, at its most simplest, it comes down to the fact that you had high technology and low technology coming together. High technology, quick-firing artillery, big cannons and machine guns. Low technology, the Mark I spade, with which you would draw, which you would dig a sort of a narrow, wiggly hole, call it a trench, and put some barbed wire out in front. Put a man in a trench, he's quite a difficult target to hit. A man walking across no man's land to attack that trench, of course, is a really obvious target. And this was the sort of problem that the armies of Europe struggled with between 1914 and 1918. And the British, actually, at the end, were probably the best army in the world. They learned a huge amount from what went on the Western Front. And the British, the French, and the Germans all simultaneously more or less came up with the same solutions. And the Somme, dreadful though it is to put it in these terms, and I'm aware of what I'm saying as I say that, actually was a critical learning stage in this process of learning how to fight modern wars. If you talk to any modern soldier and tell him about what was happening in the First World War, he'll nod and say, yeah, that's more or less what we do today, in a very, very primitive form. And so that is the sort of background, of course. Well, why didn't they simply end the war in the middle? Because somebody, as in the Germans, was sitting on somebody else's territory, Belgium and France, and until very late in the day when the German army was being built, being beaten, they weren't prepared to give that territory up. And so, locked into that sort of situation, then the battle went on. What about Douglas Haig himself? Well, I think it's fair to say that if I was allowed to sort of choose one general from history to go for a pint with, it wouldn't be Dougie. Even his closest friends, you know, would have these accounts of these lunches à deux, which had thunderous silences, and he was quite a difficult man. Although actually, some of his staff got to know him and really genuinely came to love him as an individual. He wasn't a callous man. He was, however, the man who had the largest army that Britain has ever produced under his hand. And as another general, the French general Mangin, known as the Butcher, once put it, no matter what you do, you lose a lot of men. And because Haig was in charge of the army when the British army lost more men than in any other point in history, it's not surprising that he has borne the burden of guilt. Now, having said that, Haig undeniably made some mistakes with very, very grievous consequences, although, of course, whatever he did wrong is going to be magnified because of the sheer size of the army. And yet, I don't think we can see what happened in 1916 on the Somme without putting into context of what happened 2 years later in 1918, when Haig was the leader of the largest British army in history, which won the largest series of victories in British history. Now, I'd like to believe that on the 8th of August 2018, we'll have all the same level of commemorations for the Battle of Amiens, the battle which began was the beginning of the end of the First World War, that we've just had for the 1st of July 1916 for the Somme, but I'm not that naive. There's something in the British psyche which actually doesn't like victories very much. There's certainly something which has got into our psyche about the First World War, which for very understandable reasons has come to be seen to represent everything that is dreadful, everything that's ghastly about warfare. And I'm not denying that there's actually a fair measure of truth in that. But given that the war had to be fought, people at the time certainly thought so, I think we ought to be remembering the victories of 1918 as much as the defeats of 1916. And I don't think I'm probably going to convert anybody to being a Haig fan by saying, actually, he was a really good administrator, but he was. And I think it's unfair to see him or judge him rather simply on his role as a battlefield general, because he actually had a much bigger role than that. He was the senior Brit in France, dealing with the Allies. He was the senior Brit in theatre, dealing with the government and just about everything else. And also, of course, he was commanding the armies. Frankly, he had too many plates spinning, and occasionally one or two of them dropped. But overall, I think that Haig deserves credit, alongside the things he undoubtedly did wrong, as the man who did more than anybody else to pull this disparate army of soldiers, soldiers inverted commas, who had been bank clerks and dustmen only 2 years before, actually into a highly effective fighting force with very, very modern means of fighting, and led them to victory in 1918. Now, I'm well aware that it's not much of a slogan to sell a book. Douglas Haig, not as bad as you think he is. But that's actually about the gist of my argument. I mean, I certainly would not go the whole hog and say that Haig was one of the greatest generals of history. I don't think he was. But for this, we're actually posing the wrong question if we say that. You can't really measure up Napoleon or Alexander the Great with Haig, because Napoleon and Alexander the Great didn't have to cope with administering an army of a major industrial power in a total war. So Haig really has very, very few peers to compare with. But unless I think at the end of it, Haig is a much more interesting man. I certainly thought so at the end of my research that I at the beginning. And I think a man who does deserve some of the credit for the victory in 1918. And my final point is, I think it's a great historical tragedy that the men who fought in the First World War, from Haig downwards, have been tarred with the brush that somehow they fought and in some cases died in vain. It's not true. And it's about time we stop saying it. The men of 1914 to 18 deserve more than that from us. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much indeed.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production for the Oldie Magazine. For more information, go to radiogorgeous.com.